everyone here. Good afternoon, everyone there. We have a couple of topics on our agenda this morning, the first one being revenue recognition. But before we do that, I wanted to just say congratulations to Sue Lloyd. We heard the great news about her being appointed to the board of the IASB, and we think that's just wonderful, wonderful news, and look forward to working with you in a few months in that new capacity. But we thought that was just terrific. I wanted to acknowledge it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. But she will have to learn to come in time.
We call that board member time. with that, why don't I hand over to Kristen Bauer, who is, I think, going to start us off on revenue recognition.
Great. Thanks, Leslie. And we have one topic to talk about today, and it's paper 7A. Which deals with a question related to some credit card reward programs. So with that and getting rid of the jackhammers, we'll go over to Gary to lead us through this paper. Gary?
Thanks, Kristen. So, yeah, this is paper 7A or 170A on application of the model to credit card reward programs. Now, you know, we recently had some ed sessions on this, so I'm not going to kind of do a repeat of what I said recently because I'm probably the only one who likes to hear the sound of my voice. But maybe what I will do is make a couple of observations or comments on some of the discussion that was had at the ed session and how that might impact kind of the decisions that we're going to ask you to make today. I guess the first point is just that, you know, of the relatively few respondents who commented on the specific issue, I think it's important just to bear in mind that several of them were saying that it was really example 24 in the 2011 ED that was giving them a problem. So there were some who said they wanted quite a bit more, but there were really quite a few of them who said, it's really that example that troubles us. We think we can analyze the transaction and come to an answer that we think is correct in terms of the model you've developed. But what they really struggled with was they said there's this example 24 on customer loyalty program, and we're not sure whether or not that means that for a credit card reward program, we need to account for it in the same way by analogy. So it was really example 24 that was giving them the problem, which is why in the staff recommendation, we think that we would address quite a lot of that concern by amending that example to make it clear that it's not the definitive guidance for all credit card reward programs. I think, again, then in terms of the ed session, I think some board members were suggesting maybe providing some more examples or a specific example on a credit card arrangement. And I think, you know, the staff think that there's a couple of problems with that. I think the one would be that in looking at this issue, we've understood, and I think this was acknowledged in the ed session, that these transactions can be incredibly complex and varied in their application in practice. And so to try and write one example that tries to capture all of the complexity and variation, I think would be doing a disservice to what happens in the real world. And I think secondly, if we think that a lot of the problem was created by example 24, which wasn't really even on point for credit cards, and people said, well, does that mean that's always the answer I have to get for a credit card arrangement? If we try and write an example on credit cards and we say these are the very specific fact patterns, it's gonna be even harder for someone who says, well, I don't think my fact pattern is the same, to say that they would get to a different answer based on how they were already troubled by example 24, which wasn't on point. Again, just based on some of the ed session comments, I think the staff think that if we had to do more, what we could possibly do is maybe hum a couple more bars in the basis of conclusions and just say, you know, when the board's considered these types of arrangements, you know, if you decide to, the guidance is, you know, it would be too specific. However, if we wanted to give people a steer in the type of things they should think about, we can pull some of the stuff from the paper that we thought about and maybe put that in the basis to say, in this type of arrangement, the board's acknowledged that the revenue standard already has the tools that you would need to analyze this type of transaction. For example, it tells you that if there's an FI piece to this arrangement, first consider the FI piece. After that, you'd need to consider who you believe your customer is in one of these complicated arrangements if there's more than one party. And I mean, we explain that in paragraph 32 of the paper, the thought process that someone would go through rather than actual giving a specific answer. I think with that, then, that's kind of all I'll say. And then in terms of the questions for the board, then, the two questions in the paper are whether the boards agree that the 2011 ED includes the principles that an entity would need to apply to determine the accounting for a variety of credit card reward programs. And if so, do the boards agree with what we've got in as a staff recommendation at the moment, which is just to make a a minor clarification to example 24 that this doesn't apply to all more or more complex transactions, for example, where you had more than two parties in the arrangement. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Gary. Hans, why don't I suggest that you start over there to give us a little bit more time to quiet things down over here.
Okay, thank you. All right, I open the floor. Daryl.
I guess I'm repeating a little bit of what I said yesterday, and I think we've added a bit of a nuance to the proposal from yesterday. I was very comfortable with where the staff proposal got to. In my experience, exactly the comments Gary has made, there are a myriad of different potential credit card models. PK yesterday, when he was talking, spoke about the open loop and the closed loop. And if it were just those two, it might be simpler to come up with an example that covers both of them. But there are any number of models in between those two extremes. And I'm just concerned that any time we put an example in, it becomes sort of the gold standard. It becomes the approach that everybody has to follow. And people stop necessarily taking account of the nuances. So I'd be very against putting an example in. I think it just leads people down a garden path. In terms of the kind of nuance that you brought in now with the idea of putting something in the basis or giving people a little bit more guidance in terms of the approach they would follow, I think I also touched on this yesterday, but Patricia's example that she raised yesterday was the thing that sort of brought it to my mind, is that the problem we've got is that everywhere you go, you hear people asking you, well, how would this transaction operate? How would that transaction go? And I think once we open the door to giving guidance to a particular type of transaction in the basis, in examples, anywhere else, we open ourselves to any number of requests for this sort of thing. I think the model works. I think the model makes sense. I think you can get where you want to with everything that's here. And I think people should be left to exercise judgment.
Patricia?
I agree with the staff recommendation in question one. I think that the staff draft includes the principles that an entity would need to apply to determine the correct accounting. With regard to question two, I think this we're going to have to be careful with the wording, because all of the examples are examples, and none of them should be taken as the illustration of how to apply it in your situation. The entity has to look at the facts and circumstances of its individual situation in all cases, not just in this case. So I am a little concerned that we might say that for this example and not for the other example, leading people to think the other examples are firm. That's what you do without considering the other facts and circumstances. So just caution.
PK.
Gary, will you promise me this is the last time you're coming to the board? I have two comments to make.
I can't make that promise.
Then I have to reserve my compliments. It's a very well-written paper, and I congratulate you and the team in bringing this paper. I think it brings to the focus the issues that would be attending in situations where it is a closed loop or an open loop, and I think you have been very cute in your paragraph number. I better get it fast. Paragraph number 8, and you did say in the last sentence, for a relatively simple presentation, the example that you have in the para 6 itself is a very simple example, and that looks very complicated to many people. So I think your balancing of not putting an example and putting appropriate wording, even after considering Patricia's comments, would go a long way in removing the confusion that is out there. The fascinating thing I found in my outreach to the two people who do both the closed loop and the open loop is that both are comfortable with the answer they get to. The only thing they wanted us to is to not to opine one way or the other. And the examples that you might put would unnecessarily tilt the discussion one way or the other, either innocently or deliberately. But I think the point is that people are comfortable where they are. We don't need to expand on it as long as we perhaps add the wording despite Patricia's comment in example 24, I think it will go a long way in addressing it. And I think Daryl made this point. If you try to do this, there could be any number of myriad situations that we need to address. That's something we need to think about. And Gary, your comment about putting it in the basis of conclusion, whilst it sounds appealing on the surface of it, I would like you to hum few more bars, to use your own words, to tell us what you want to put there. In the sense, because again, I don't want this to be a code for one way or the other. So I just want you to be very clear what you want to put it in the basis of conclusion.
I mean, I think, first of all, I think we would still be sticking with the staff recommendation. I think as staff, we still think that that is the best path forward. I think what I was saying is, based on some of the comments that were made by board members in the ED session, specifically maybe more so on the FASB side, but it seemed that if the boards felt that we needed to do something more, I think we as staff were saying we think the best we could possibly do, or the most appropriate thing we could do, is put something in the basis rather. And in terms of what we would put, kind of thinking in terms of the way the basis is written, you know, the boards were asked by specific industries to answer this type of fact pattern. The boards decided not to because they thought the model already included all of the principles or tools, or whatever, we'd use a different word, that an entity would need to answer this question. For example, the boards noted that, you know, the revenue standard already provides guidance on when you have a transaction that includes an FI piece, do the FI piece. The boards noted that the standard requires you to identify their customer in your arrangement, which even when they're multiple parties, you need to apply your judgment and do that. Boards noted that the guidance already tells you when you're determining if someone is acting, what the nature of their promise is, if they're acting as an agent or a principal. Consequently, the boards decided not to provide specific guidance. It's just high level.
Okay.
We go.
No, I fully agree with staff proposals and not provide the guidance based on specific scenario. And as Daryl said, we can give different kind of examples and put more entities into it. And when I read this paper, I remember one stories I once experienced. You know, there is a Chinese company, software company, earn a lot of money, and a listed company. I asked him what they are doing. He said, we're doing a very, very sophisticated software. And originally, they designed a software to allocate the commissions of investments. And I said, why is it so complicated? He said, you pay 0.3% to the dealers, investment through buy or sell shares. But these 0.3% may be divided into more than 10 entities. You know, the clearing house, the stock exchange, the regulators, the banks, the telecom companies, and the credit card companies. And all have related transaction tax. So they subject tax authorities. And you pay 0.3% within second. The money goes to different places. And then, of course, there are revenue recognition problems among different entities, whether you pay low as an agent or pay low as a principals. And then the company sell more products to different kind of industry. This is one example. I think the key ideas behind the paper is, you know, the revenue standards are general recognition standards. When the transaction involve multi parties, and how should we provide guidance? Generally speaking, we should not provide, you know, specific guidance based on specific scenarios. Fully agree with that proposal.
Any more suggestions, questions? No. Over to you, Leslie.
Comments, Larry?
I guess it surprised some people, but in the notes, in the margins of the memo, I specifically said that we should provide more examples because I wasn't sure how it would work. I did not participate in the FASB's education session, but I went to the videotape and watched it. And my reaction to that was that the board members generally appeared not to agree. on how to account for different arrangements, and so therefore that convinced me further that we probably needed some examples. I went to a small group meeting last evening, or yesterday afternoon, and again there seemed to be disagreement among board members. But the disagreement, I think, arises because of perhaps not a level understanding or consistent understanding of the terms of the transactions. And someone said something, I think it was Daryl, that companies know how to do it based upon their facts and circumstances, but there's just concern with the example that we had provided in the ED. And therefore, I guess I've changed my mind and I've listened to what you all have said. And I would say at this stage, let's not provide specific guidance because to the point Gary made with his tee up, we might just be confusing things because we're oversimplifying some of the facts and circumstances. That being said, I say let's not go out with any concrete examples or what have you. Have a lot of lead time between when this gets issued and when it gets when it's effective, and we have, at least in the U.S., no early implementation, if I recall. So I would suggest that we do some specific outreach during the time period prior to the effective date and talk to various financial institutions and the auditors and see how they've assessed their situations and whether there are agreements or disagreements among the parties. And based upon that, we can decide to provide more implementation guidance if necessary. And the necessity would be provoked by similar fact patterns getting very different accounting, and go with it that way. So I would agree with the staff recommendation, but preface it by saying that I think we have to do specific outreach to determine how people are assessing different fact patterns and then evaluate whether we think there's going to be consistency.
Larry, the objective of that, quote, outreach would be to identify whether people have questions about how to apply the guidance. Because if the objective of it is for us to opine on it at a later date...
No, it's not to opine. It's the objective is to determine how people are interpreting the guidance and for us to evaluate whether we think there's consistency in that interpretation. If there's gross inconsistency, then we might want to do something.
I would agree with everything that Larry said. I've struggled with this issue like everyone else. We've already said there are a wide range of transactions and arrangements. They're complex. I would add that they're also evolving. They're evolving because of legislation, regulation, and litigation. If there's any question about that, just pick up the paper in the last 2 days, and you'll see a wide range of issues from Federal Reserve studies to litigation that is continuing, and we'll see how that turns out. So I think that anything more than what we have today without some official study would, I think, put us in a more difficult situation a year or two down the road. So I very much agree with what Larry said.
Yeah.
Well, like Larry, I've been around the block in terms of my thinking on this question. You know, my fear is that there will be uncertainty in application out there, which would result in diversity and that, you know, it would end up being EITF issue 17-A right off the bat. So my first thought was to provide some examples for clarity, but I think the staff has convinced me that, you know, there could be consequences to that would be unfavorable. And so yesterday in the small group discussion that I had, I was sort of going down the track of thinking, well, maybe we could just provide sort of a decision tree, if you will, for these types of arrangements, not coming to a conclusion, but helping people think through step by step what you would do. But even on that, you know, the staff pointed out that essentially would just be a recitation of the model, and just be duplicative, if you will. So I think I've come all the way around to agreeing with the staff recommendation that we just need to make it clear with this example 24, as Patricia said, that be careful with the wording, but indicate that it's not intended to be the answer for every arrangement that's out there. We'll add something to the basis, but let the model work. So I agree with that.
Thank you. Other comments? Tom?
I'm going to agree with the staff recommendation, but except with one thing. I am uncomfortable having an override caveat in example 24. In part because no matter what I think about in these contracts, when I'm an issuer, if I'm the issuing card company, I can't see that there isn't a separate performance obligation related to loyalty. It's separate from the loan. It's delivered at a different point in time. It's available in the market typically separately from the loan on its own. I think it's very much like what we talk about in the extended warranty examples. I just don't see ever getting to a point where there isn't a separate performance obligation there. However, I'm not going to want to opine that it applies to credit cards, but I'm worried about overriding example 24. I would rather that we not give guidance, that we not override example 24, and we do what Gary talked about in the basis to say when the boards discussed credit cards, we decided not to give an example because they're so unique circumstances. You have to apply the model. Here are some of the areas of the model that you have to be thinking about and applying it, and stop there. One other area I think that we haven't talked about is combination of contracts. And I think that is something that you have to evaluate. Paragraph 17B says the amount of consideration to be paid in one contract depends on the price or performance of the other contract. Well, I think in the closed loop system, you begin to think about that particular issue. So
you think about it, but there are other factors you have to consider
right.
In guidance on combination of contracts, including that it's the same part.
Yes, and I'm not saying, I'm not opining on it. I'm just saying you ought to be evaluating that issue as well.
Okay, any other comments? The only other comment that I'd like to make is that in U.S. GAAP, we have guidance in FAS 91 that gives prescriptive guidance right now about credit card fees. And I was persuaded by the letter that came in the other day that we may need to take a look at that because the nature of those arrangements have changed over time such that the fee can cover things that clearly are distinct from the lending arrangement. For example, an insurance premium, if you happen to take that election under your card. So I was persuaded that we probably should narrow the scope of that to say fees in association or, that are related to the lending arrangement, which would then allow room for an interpretation to say some of that belongs with these other services. Other than that, that's a U.S. issue because our guidance there is prescriptive. But other than that, does anyone disagree with the staff recommendations?
No. And that means we're going to override example 24.
I don't view it as overriding. I don't think example 24 was ever contemplated to be this fact pattern. And I think Gary described it as the problem we're here to solve was not, it was a misunderstanding of the original problem we're trying to solve. So all we're saying is read example 24 and apply it to those facts, not other facts.
What I read in question two is that the existence of a customer loyalty program does not automatically result in award credit. It's not an automatic, and you have to consider all the factors and facts and circumstances. And I think, when the staff has described facts and circumstances to me where there might be performance obligations associated with a loyalty program, but there might be situations where it's more questionable. I just think it's not automatic, and I think that's all, hopefully, we're trying to say in what you're calling the override. Hopefully, it's just saying it's just not automatic.
I would be willing to say something like, to the extent that the transaction involves other elements, such as a lending arrangement, multiple parties, et cetera, those facts and circumstances would need to be evaluated under other elements of the model, something like that. Is that okay?
Yes.
Anything else, Kristen?
No, did they vote on the other side, or did they?
No. Okay, Hans, back to you.
Do we have any disagreement here with the staff's recommendations?
No.
We agree. Okay. That's all for you?
And then we'll switch to...